Van Sciver's permanently dilated pupils stared out, glossy with hidden depths, a bullseye waiting for a round. Evan pictured his thumb sinking through it, scrambling the frontal lobe. Evan closed to within 10 yards of him, when something stopped him in his tracks. Van Sciver was smiling. With some effort, he raised his arm and pointed behind Evan. As Evan turned, Joey stumbled off the lowered platform lift onto the dirt, both hands locked around her thigh just above the knee. She wobbled on her feet, bleeding out. 74. Brightness off her skin. Evan froze between Van Sciver and Joey, his body tugged in opposite directions. A few strides ahead was the man who had killed Jack, and 15 yards behind, Joey stood doubled over, the life draining from her body. A feeling overtook Evan, that of free-falling through the night sky just as Jack had. There were no bearings, just a spin of sensation and the pinpoint light of distant stars. He stared at the butt of the fallen rifle ahead, the dilated pupil beckoning his thumb. Van Sciver was breathing hard. "Looks like I clipped her superficial femoral artery." Evan glanced back at Joey. She gasped, her legs nearly buckling. Evan tore his gaze away, took another step for Van Sciver. "She's gonna die," Van Sciver said. "You want to be with her when she does." Evan halted again, teeth locked in a grimace. He thought about Jack plummeting through a void, his willingness to step off a helicopter to protect Evan. "The best part of me." Evan took an uneven step backward, and then another. Then he spun and ran to Joey. Behind him he heard Van Sciver's laugh, the rasp of sandpaper. "That's the difference between me and you." Evan reached Joey as her legs gave out, catching her as she collapsed. He flicked out his Strider knife and sheared her jeans to the thigh, exposing the bullet hole. There was blood. So much blood. The femoral artery, just as Van Sciver had said. Evan initiated the bone phone. "Tommy, get here. Now. Get here now." He did not recognize his own voice. He clamped his hand over Joey's thigh.
"Copy that," Tommy said. "En route."
"Now! We have to get her to medical!" Across the stretch of dirt, Evan watched Van Sciver wriggle his shoulders up the side of the Tahoe, shoving himself to a standing position. He fell into the driver's seat. The SUV drove off, its momentum kicking the door shut.
"You let Van Sciver go," Joey said weakly.
Evan pictured again the serene expression on Jack's face as he'd stepped from the Black Hawk, and he understood at last what had filled him with such peace. Joey blinked languidly.
"What? Come back for me?"
Evan drew in a breath that felt like broken glass. He said, "That's what my father taught me." He bent over Joey, his hand still sealed on her leg. The sound of the Tahoe faded, leaving the valley desolate, overtaken by late twilight gloom. They were a stone's throw from the busiest freeway intersection in the world, and yet not another human was in sight. She looked up at him, her emerald eyes glazed. "You were supposed to jump," he said, "across the freeway, away from all this." His eyes were wet.
"God damn it! What did I teach you?"
She said,
"Everything."
Her dark hair was thrown back, exposing the bristle of that shaved strip, the faraway city lights turning a few strands golden, and he realized that at some point over their days and nights, he'd come to know the scent of her, a citrus brightness off her skin.
"You're okay," he said.
"You're gonna be fine," he said. "You're worth it," he said. Her lips pressed together, a weak smile. He tightened his clamp on her leg. Headlights swept the valley, a vehicle approaching. It parked, the glare making him squint. The door slammed shut. A figure stepped forward, cut from the brilliance of the headlights. Not Tommy. Candy. Evan's last ray of hope left him. Candy approached, appraising them. "Find what they love," she said, "and make them pay for it." Evan would have to let go of Joey's leg to reach for his knife on the ground. He did not. He stayed where he was, his palm covering her wound. He closed his eyes, saw his tiny feet filling Jack's footsteps in the woods. This was the path he was born to follow. A path into life, no matter the cost. When he opened his eyes, Candy was standing right over him, the barrel of her pistol inches from his forehead. In his arms, he could feel Joey's breaths, each more fragile than the last. Evan stared up the barrel at Candy. "After you kill me, clamp this artery." Candy said nothing. He said, "Please." The end of Candy's pistol trembled ever so slightly. Her face contorted. Evan looked back down at Joey. After a moment, he sensed the pistol lower. Candy eased back from view. He barely registered the sound of the SUV driving away. Joey jerked in a few shallow breaths. She raised a hand to his cheek, left a smudge of blood under his eye. He sensed it there, a weighted shadow.
"I see you," she said. "You're still real."
As he heard Tommy's truck shudder to a stop behind him, her eyes rolled up and closed, and her head nodded back in his arms. 75. The Blackness to Come. Evan's hands rested in his lap, covered with blood. Crimson gloves. Tommy drove through darkest night. Los Angeles was well behind them, Las Vegas well ahead. They had handled what they'd needed to handle. "I know you're emotional," Tommy said, "but we gotta think straight." Evan said, "I'm not emotional." His voice shook. "This is next level shit," Tommy said. "We gotta go to ground. A few weeks minimum. See what shakes out. I got a ranch in Victorville, completely off the grid." Evan stared out the window. The blackness sweeping by looked like the blackness before, and the blackness to come. Tommy kept talking, but Evan didn't hear him. Candy McClure sat on the carpet of her empty safe house, knees drawn to her chest. Past the tips of her bare feet, her phone rested on the floor. It was after midnight, and yet she'd felt no need to turn on the lights. She had no idea how long she'd been sitting like this. Her hamstrings and calves ached. Even her Achilles tendons throbbed. She was having what more poetic types might call a crisis of conscience. The Samsung might ring. Or it might never ring again. If it did, she had no idea what she'd do. It was one of those wait-and-see things. And she wasn't really a wait-and-see girl. Or at least, she didn't used to be. What was she now? The phone vibrated against the carpet, uplighting her face with a bluish glow. The signal application, presenting her with a two-word code. It was Van Sciver. Somehow alive. She found herself not answering. An unanswered phone seems to ring forever. At last it stopped rattling against the floorboards. She picked it up. She keyed in a different phone number. 1-855-2-NOWHERE. She stared at the phone, the empty house seeming to curl around her like the ribcage of some long-dead beast. She hung up before the call could ring through. She pressed the Samsung to her lips and thought for a time. Then she set it on the floor, rose, and walked out. She took nothing. She didn't bother to lock the door behind her. She wouldn't be coming back. 76. Something flat and unchanging. Van Sciver reclined on his bed in the ICU, his face washed of color. A gray sweat layered his flesh as he dozed, his eyelids flickering. A urinary catheter threaded between his legs. A monitor read his heart rate, oxygen saturation, respiratory rate, blood pressure, and half a dozen other vitals. A central line on the left side of his chest fed in nutrition and vitamins from a bright yellow bag of TPN. It was a private room, the curtains pulled around to shield his bed from the glass walls and door. In one hand, he clutched his Samsung. It chimed, awakening him. The signal application. Was it Candy? Finally back in contact? Weakly, he raised the phone to his unshaven cheek. Code, he said. Orphan X's voice said, behind you. The words came at Van Sciver in stereo. Through the phone, yes, but also from inside the room. Evans stepped into view, let the Samsung slide from his hand onto the sheets. Van Sciver stared at him, mouth open, jaw slightly askew. Evan lifted Van Sciver's personal Samsung from his frail clutch. Finding him hadn't been easy. But it hadn't been hard either. Without immediate surgical intervention and repair, an injury to the superior mesenteric artery compromised blood flow, which in turn meant that the patient usually lost most of the small bowel to necrosis. Small bowel transplants were rare, and donors rarer yet, but given Van Sciver's resources, he'd know how to get himself to the top of the list. Due to the severity of the injury, he would not have been able to travel far. The UCLA Medical Center was the only adult small bowel transplant center in the greater Los Angeles area. Without Joey around to help, it had taken some doing for Evan to hack into UCLA's Epic medical record system, but when he had, he'd found an anonymous patient admitted on December 4th, 2 weeks back, who showed no healthcare history. Evan eased forward, so Van Sciver could see him without straining. I did go back for Joey, Evan said, and that does make us different. You know what else makes us different? You're in that bed now, and I'm standing. He held up an empty syringe. With this. Van Sciver peered up helplessly. His hand fished in the rumpled sheets and emerged with the call button. His thumb clicked it a few times. I disconnected it, Evan told him. Then I watched you sleep for a while. Through gaps in the curtain, they could see doctors and nurses passing by, their faces lowered to charts. Evan knew that Van Sciver wouldn't cry out for help. Help would come too late. And he had too much pride for that anyway. Van Sciver's features grew lax, defeated. A milky starburst showed in that blown pupil, floating like a distant galaxy. Evan reached over and crimped the tube feeding the central line, stopping the flow of fluorescent yellow nutrition into Van Sciver's chest. You killed Jack to get to me, Evan said. Congratulations. You got your wish. He slid the needle into the tube above the crimp, closer to Van Sciver's body. Together they watched the air bubble creep along the line, nearing Van Sciver's chest. It would ride his central vein into his heart, causing an embolism. The dot of air inched along, ever closer. Van Sciver's face settled with resignation. He said, "It is what it is, and that's all that it is." No, Evan said. It's more than that. The air bubble slipped through the line into Van Sciver's chest. A moment later, he shuddered. His left eye dilated, at last matching the right. The symphony of beeps and hums from the monitor changed their melody into something flat and unchanging. When doctors and nurses crashed into the room, they found the motionless body. And no one else. 77. Original SWAT. She remembered two rough men minding her in the darkness, one scented of soap and sweat, the other moving through a haze of cigarette smoke and wintergreen tobacco. And there was a hospital room that was not in a hospital, and a doctor or two drifting through the miasma of her drugged thoughts. Now she looked out her dorm window onto the stunning view beyond, Lake Lugano and the snow-capped Alps. It was an English-speaking school filled with affluent kids, a demographic to which she supposed she now belonged. 793 students from 62 countries, speaking 40 different languages. A good pot to melt into and disappear. Her passport and papers had her at 18 years old, a legal adult, so she could oversee her own affairs. Her cover was thorough and backstopped. She'd been recently orphaned, set up with a trust fund that released, like a widening faucet, a little more money every year. She was repeating coursework here after some understandable emotional difficulties, given the fresh loss of her parents. She'd pick up courses at the second semester, which began in a few weeks. The campus was spectacular, the resources seemingly unlimited. There was a downhill ski team and horseback riding and kickboxing, though she'd have to be careful if she chose to indulge in the last. She was due to matriculate today, a simple ceremony. Her roommate, an unreasonably lovely Dutch teenager, was coming to fetch her at any minute. She set her foot on her bed and leaned over it, stretching the scar tissue. The last thing she'd remembered before going out was looking up at Evan, his hand over her leg, holding her blood in her veins, holding her tight enough to keep her alive. They could never see each other again. Given who he was, it was too risky, and he was unwilling to put her in harm's way. But he had given her this. He had given her the world. She pulled open the window and breathed in the air, fresher than any she'd ever tasted. There was a knock at her door. She opened it, expecting Sarah, but instead it was the school porter, a kindly man with chapped cheeks. He handed her a rectangular box wrapped in plain brown paper and said, in gently accented English, "This came for you, Miss Vera." "Thank you, Calvin." She took it over to the bed and sat. The package bore no return address. Postage imprints indicated that it had traveled through various mail forwarding services. She tore back the brown wrapping and saw that it was a wide shoebox. Lettered on the lid, "Original SWAT Boots." Her heart changed its movement inside her chest. She opened the shoebox's lid. Inside, dozens and dozens of sealed envelopes formed razor-neat rows. With a trembling hand, she lifted the first one. On the front, written in precise block lettering, "Open now." She ran a finger beneath the envelope flap and slid out an undecorated card. She opened it. Inside, the same block lettering. "It's your first day. Try not to screw it up too bad. X." Her hand had moved to her mouth. She stared at the words, and then over at the box of envelopes. The next one up said, "Christmas." As she slipped the card back into the envelope, she noticed some lettering on the back. YAS. YAL. It took a moment for the meaning to drop. These were the words she'd overheard that young father speak to his newborn in the park the day she'd wandered by, bleeding from one ear. "You are safe. You are loved." Another knock sounded, and she wiped at her eyes. Sarah's gentle voice carried through the door. "Are you ready?" Joey slid the shoebox beneath her bed and rose. "Yeah," she said. "I am." 78. Worth the Trying. As Evan crossed the lobby of Castle Heights, Laura Lee looked up from her mail slot and caught his eye. She was alone. She smiled at him, and the smile held deeper meaning. He nodded, accepting her thanks. He neared the security desk across from the elevator. 21, please, Joaquin. Joaquin looked up, his security hat tilted. "Hey, Mr. Smoke.
Haven't seen you in a while.
Evan grimaced. Sales conferences.
Living for the weekend.
You got that right. A voice floated from behind Evan.
12th floor too, Joaquin.
Sure thing, Mrs. Hall.
Evan held the elevator doors, and Mia slipped past him, her curly hair brushing his cheek. The doors closed, and they regarded each other. He tried not to notice the birthmark at her temple, the line of her neck, her bottom lip.
Sales conferences. She smirked. Ever wonder which identity is the real one?
He said, lately. And now that full grin broke across her face, the one he felt in his spinal cord.
How are you, Evan? Really, how are you?
Good.
I'm good.
And he was. At long last, Charles Van Sciver was wiped off the books. All that remained of him was the Samsung in the right front pocket of Evan's cargo pants, pressing against his thigh. Other matters had been put to rest as well. Benito Oriana's next credit card bill would show a balance of zero. The medical debts from his wife's illness settled in full. He would still have his primary mortgage, but the second lender who had nailed him with a predatory rate had been paid off. An unfortunate glitch in the same lender's system had led to the disappearance of a six-figure chunk from the escrow account. This morning, the McClare Children's Mental Health Center in Richmond had received an anonymous donation that happened to match the six-figure chunk that had gone missing from the escrow account. The money had been earmarked for improving living conditions, quality of care, and the security system. It could also pay for a lot of Lego snowspeeders. The package of letters that Evan had sent would have arrived today, helping kick off a new life for a 16-year-old girl an ocean away. Jack had always taught Evan that the hard part wasn't being a killer. The hard part was staying human. He was superb at the former, and growing proficient at the latter. It was worth the trying.
I'm sad it didn't work out between us like we hoped, Mia said.
Me too.
Peter misses you.
I miss you too.
Evan thought about a different life in which he could have been another man for them. For himself.
I have to look out for him, Mia said, no matter what I might want for myself. I have to protect him at all costs.
Evan said,
I get it.
She tilted her head, seemingly moved.
Do you?
Yes, he said.
I do.
The doors opened at the 12th floor. And Mia got out. She turned and faced him, as if she wanted to say something else, though there was nothing else to say. He knew the feeling. The doors slid shut between them. He rode to his floor, entered the penthouse. He went immediately to the freezer and removed the walnut chest. Opening the hand-blown glass bottle, he poured himself two fingers of Stoli Elite Himalayan Edition, at about $100 a finger. He'd earned it. The penthouse felt vast and empty. A ring remained on the counter from Joey's OJ glass. He'd have to scrub it in the morning. He thought about the mess of gear awaiting him in the vault, a mirror for the exquisite complexities inside Joey's head. The equipment would take days to untangle. He paused at the base of the spiral staircase. Her absence flowed down from the loft, a stillness in the air. He found himself listening for the clack of her speed cube, or the bump of a kite against his bedroom window. But now, there would only be quiet. Drifting to the floor-to-ceiling windows, he let the first sip burn its way down his throat, exquisite and cleansing. He looked out at all those apartments on vertical display. Families were beginning to light up their Christmas trees. He heard Jack's voice in his ear. I love you, son. Evan raised his glass in a toast.
Copy that, he said.
Only once he'd finished the two fingers of vodka, only once he'd washed and dried the glass and set it back in its place in the cupboard, did he remove Van Sciver's Samsung from his pocket. He read the last texted message from December 4th yet again. V.S. After I get X, can the girl live? And the reply, no one lives. The sender of the response was coded as D.R. Dark Road. It was amazing that someone so high up would risk so much because of a mission Evan had carried out 19 years ago. He didn't know where the tendrils of that job culminated, but he intended to follow them. They led, no doubt, to the farthest reaches of power. That's where the darkness was. And the gold. He'd raised the question himself to Joey. How much is regime change worth? A well-placed bullet can change the direction of a nation, tip the balance of power, so a country's interests align with ours. He had fired a number of such bullets in his lifetime. Maybe the round he'd let fly in 1997 had been one of them. Clearly he'd been a link in a chain, and he would devote himself now to discerning the contours of that chain, to seeing just how far up it stretched. He stared at that text once again. No one lives. He had something else to devote himself to as well. He crossed to the kitchen island where the red notebook waited. He flipped it open, that scrawl standing out in relief where Joey had shaded the page. 6-14-14, Dark Road 32. A switchboard. A code word. An extension. He took out his roam zone. And he dialed. On the Resolute desk, the middle of the three black phones rang. President Bennett was not sitting there waiting. He remained on the couch alone, holding a glass of Premier Cru Bordeaux in his famously steady hand. No sweat sparkling at his graying temples, his breath slow and steady. The past few weeks would have reduced a lesser man to a stressed-out wreck. But he was Jonathan Bennett, and his body obeyed his will. He crossed the Oval Office and lifted the receiver. He said nothing. A voice said, "You should have left 1997 in the past." Bennett gave his allotted 2-second pause and then said, "If you look into it, I will crush you." Orphan X saw Bennett's 2 seconds and raised him a few more. Then he said, "I think you misunderstand the purpose of this call, Mr. President. Looking into it's not good enough for me." "What does that mean?" Bennett said, only now realizing he'd rushed his response. The disembodied voice said, "You greenlit Jack Jones's death, and the girl's death, and so many others." Bennett reseated his eyeglasses on the bridge of his nose, which felt suddenly moist. "I'm listening." Orphan X said, "This is me, greenlighting yours." The phone clicked, the line severed. Bennett breathed, and breathed again. He placed the phone receiver back in its cradle. He circled the Resolute desk, sat down, and set his hands on the blotter. They were shaking. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Hellbent by Greg Hurwitz, performed by Scott Brick. Performance copyright 2017 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.